Welcome back. In this lesson, we're exploring scholarly versus non-scholarly sources, specifically Lesson 2.3.
Right.
If you've watched the overview, this will build on that. If not, you'll still be able to follow along. Now let's go further by connecting the topic to real university experiences, study challenges, confidence, and practical academic habits.
Yeah, I am so glad we're getting into this today because, well, the overarching mission of this deep dive is really to help you build stronger academic arguments and, you know, to help you avoid the pitfalls of misinformation that are just everywhere online.
Right, because relying on inappropriate information, it doesn't just, like, lead to weak arguments or a bad grade. It's deeper than that.
Oh, absolutely. It actively damages your credibility as a scholar. I mean, it makes a reader, usually your professor, question your fundamental judgment.
Wow. Yeah, that is a high-stakes situation.
It is. But conversely, when you master the skill of selecting the right evidence, you completely elevate the accuracy and the quality of your work. You know, you swap out weak evidence for, like, high-tensile steel cables.
I love that. So to get to that point, before you can select the best materials, you really need to understand the fundamental differences between the types of information you'll actually encounter out there.
Yes, exactly. We really need to break down the anatomy of academic evidence. And it basically falls into two main categories, right? Scholarly materials and non-scholarly materials.
Okay, so let's define those.
Well, scholarly materials are research-based, they're highly rigorous, and they undergo this strict vetting process. Non-scholarly materials, on the other hand, encompass pretty much everything else.
Everything else. Like what?
Like news articles, industry blogs, corporate websites, opinion pieces, popular magazines, all of that.
Okay, wait, I want to jump in and push back on that categorization for a second.
Sure, go for it.
Because let's say I am writing a sociology paper on, I don't know, modern media bias. Or maybe how breaking news spreads on social media.
Right.
I have to use current news articles and blogs. Right. I mean, I can't just rely on a 5-year-old journal article to analyze something happening on social media today. Does that mean non-scholarly materials are completely useless?
That is a fantastic distinction to make. And no, they aren't useless at all. It really brings up the difference between primary and secondary information.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
How does that work in this context?
Well, in your example, those news articles and social media posts, those are your primary materials. They are the actual raw subjects you are analyzing. You absolutely use them.
Right, because they're the thing I'm studying.
Exactly. But when it comes to the secondary information, like the theories, the methodologies, the framework you use to analyze those tweets, that must come from scholarly literature. You wouldn't use a random blogger's opinion to validate your academic framework, you know?
Oh, I see. I'm thinking of it kind of like a movie. Is non-scholarly info, like the trailer for a movie, good for getting the general premise or context, while the scholarly material is the actual feature film where the real substance lives?
I really like that analogy. Yes. Non-academic materials are great for initial context or as raw data, but when it comes time to make academic claims, you need the heavy lifting that peer-reviewed evidence provides.
Peer review.
Yeah. Right?
You know, when I first heard the term peer review, I literally pictured a secret society of, like, older professors in a dusty library voting on who gets to join the club.
A lot of people think that. It definitely carries this intimidating elite aura. But the reality is it's a lot more functional. It's a collaborative system designed to improve reliability.
So how does it actually work?
Well, imagine a grueling courtroom cross-examination. When a researcher finishes a study, they don't just get to publish it online. They submit their manuscript to a journal. And the editor sends it out to other experts in that exact same highly specialized field.
And those are the peers.
Exactly. And usually the author doesn't know who the reviewers are, and the reviewers don't know who the author is. It's a blind process designed to completely remove bias.
Wow. Okay. So their entire job is just to stress test the research.
Yeah.
Yes. They poke holes in the methodology, they look for confirmation bias, they demand proof for every single assertion, and they frequently send it back, demanding major revisions.
So surviving that process is what makes the scholarly article so reliable. It's not just one person's opinion.
Precisely. Now, understanding that theory is great, but...
But how do you actually find these things?
Right.
Like, if I'm a student staring at a blank screen at 11 p.m., panicking about a deadline, how do I find these battle-tested documents without wasting hours sifting through the noise?
Oh, the 11 p.m. panic. We've all been there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, practically speaking, you have to use actionable evaluation techniques.
What does that look like in practice?
It means you have to examine the fundamental purpose of the publication. Is this website trying to sell a product? Is it trying to drive ad revenue through sensationalism? Or is its sole purpose to share objective research?
And actually, universities provide the perfect shortcut for this. You don't have to guess the publication's motives because you have access to dedicated academic databases.
Yes. That is the biggest advantage you have as a student.
Right. I'm talking about digital tools like JSTOR, ERIC, or the Base search engine. When you use these dedicated databases, you're essentially searching inside a walled garden.
I love that phrase, walled garden.
Yeah, because the massive amount of unsupported web noise is just automatically filtered out at the gate.
It drastically reduces study anxiety, and it saves an immense amount of time. Instead of spending an hour trying to figure out if a website is secretly funded by a corporate interest group.
Which is surprisingly hard to figure out sometimes.
It really is. But by using JSTOR or ERIC, you can spend that time actually reading and synthesizing verified literature. It connects directly to your assignments and exams because you know the evidence will actually strengthen your academic arguments.
To really see how this transforms real university work, let's look at a concrete example. In the lesson, there's a scenario of a student who put this into practice.
Right, this student who was incredibly frustrated with their grades.
Yeah, they were putting in long hours writing these massive papers, but their grades were just stuck in the C range, and they couldn't figure out why.
It's a really common trap, especially in early undergraduate years. When we audited their process, their workflow was entirely based on Googling the topic, clicking the first three links that agreed with their thesis,
and just stitching together a Frankenstein paper out of blog posts and unverified opinion pages.
Exactly. They were confusing the act of searching with the act of researching. They thought finding a sentence online that matched their opinion was the same as finding evidence.
So what was the turning point for them? How did they pivot?
The pivot was entirely about their environment. They made a hard rule for themselves. They actively replaced those weak, unsupported websites with peer-reviewed journal articles from the academic databases.
They locked themselves in the walled garden.
They really did.
And the outcome was pretty undeniable. There was a noticeable immediate improvement in their assignment grades. But I want to break down why that happened, because it wasn't just about the URLs looking more prestigious in the bibliography.
No, not at all. It was about the structural integrity of the writing itself. When you elevate the evidence you use, you are forcing yourself to grapple with higher-level concepts.
Right. You stop merely summarizing random opinions and start synthesizing verified data.
Exactly. The academic claims became more nuanced because the literature they were reading was more nuanced and made their arguments unassailable.
Okay, so now that we've seen this concept in action, it's time to turn the lens inward. We want you to examine your own research habits.
Absolutely. Self-awareness is key here.
So ask yourself this direct prompt. How can I improve the quality of the information I use in my academic work?
To help answer that, let's do a quick mental exercise. Think of a recent assignment you wrote. Now compare one piece of scholarly evidence you used with one non-scholarly piece.
Okay, I've got two in mind.
Perfect. We are going to evaluate those two pieces against four specific metrics. The first one is credibility. Basically, who is speaking?
So, looking at the author's bio, if my non-scholarly source is a travel blogger writing about ancient Roman architecture, their motivation is probably to sell a walking tour.
Right. Right. But if your scholarly source is a tenured archaeologist, someone who has spent 20 years digging in Rome, their credibility completely changes the weight of their conclusions.
Okay, that makes sense. What's the second metric?
The second is evidence. What are they backing their claims up with?
So in the scholarly article, I'm going to see a robust bibliography, footnotes, transparent data sets. But in the non-scholarly piece, it might just be a hyperlink to another news article.
Or just a broad statement like, studies show, without ever linking to the study. That lack of transparency is a huge red flag.
Yeah, that happens all the time.
Yeah.
Okay, metric number three.
Writing style. Is the piece objective and rigorous? Non-scholarly writing relies on sensationalism and highly emotional language to keep you clicking.
But the scholarly article just wants to deliver the complex truth, even if it takes 30 pages of very neutral prose to do it.
Precisely. Which brings us to the final metric, intended audience. Is it written for other experts or the general public?
Scholarly work is a conversation between specialists, right? That's why it can be a bit dense to read at first.
Exactly. Non-scholarly work simplifies complex issues for mass consumption. Both are valuable, but only the specialist conversation is suitable for rigorous academic argumentation.
And I want to point out, doing this comparison activity, it isn't about feeling bad about past assignments. We have all cited something questionable when we're rushing for a deadline.
Oh, absolutely. I've done it.
This is just about building self-awareness and academic confidence for the next assignment.
Right. It requires a fundamental mindset shift. You have to move away from the mindset of just, you know, finding enough quotes to meet the word count.
The word count trap.
Yeah.
It's so easy to just scour the internet looking for any sentence that validates your idea so you can drop it in as a block quote.
It is, but we need to shift from that to actively practicing critical thinking. Richard Paul and Linda Elder developed a brilliant framework for this.
What's their core idea?
They define critical thinking not as tearing things down, but as the disciplined art of ensuring you are using the best thinking you are capable of. It means actively questioning your own assumptions before you even begin searching.
Wow. So like actively fighting your own confirmation bias.
Yes. You have to be willing to reject evidence that supports your claim if the methodology behind that evidence is flawed.
There are some really great resources mentioned in the lesson today that help develop this. Things like The Craft of Research by Booth, Collum, and Williams, and Writing Research Papers by Lester and Lester.
Yes, those are classics for a reason.
I really love that word, craft, because it emphasizes that research is a skill you cultivate. You aren't magically born knowing how to navigate databases.
No one is. And the best actionable step you can take right now to develop that craft is really straightforward. Next time you start an assignment, deliberately choose to start your search in JSTOR or ERIC rather than a standard web search.
Force yourself to spend that first hour inside the walled garden.
Exactly. By doing that, you ensure you are pulling from peer-reviewed pools right from the start. It lays a foundation of bedrock before you try to build the house.
Okay, let's pull all this together. The core takeaway from today is that prioritizing peer-reviewed, research-based materials strengthens your reliability and protects your academic credibility.
And while non-academic materials have their place, they require careful evaluation using our four metrics: credibility, evidence, style, and audience.
Because your selection directly impacts the quality of your work.
And look, a final encouraging thought. Building academic confidence takes consistency. It isn't an overnight thing, but every time you carefully evaluate a piece of evidence, you are becoming a stronger, more capable, lifelong learner.
To really lock these habits in, we encourage you to review the end of module study guide and complete the workbook activities to apply these source evaluation skills practically.
It makes a massive difference when you actually practice it.
It really does. We also want to acknowledge the reference materials discussed today, including The Craft of Research, the critical thinking frameworks of Paul and Elder, and databases like JSTOR, ERIC, and BASE.
They are essential tools for your academic journey.
Definitely. And before we go, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over. We are moving into an era where artificial intelligence and algorithms are generating more and more of the open web at lightning speed.
Oh, yeah. It's happening so fast.
It is. And in the very near future, the walled gardens of peer-reviewed academic databases might be the only places left where we can actually trace the origin of an idea and verify human truth.
That is a very sobering but important thought.
Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive. Keep questioning, keep evaluating, and we'll see you next time.